This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
While governance plays an issue, I don't know that it protects anyone completely from the negative impacts of mining.
One of the powers that we have as consumers is to vote with our dollars, or exercise our right to choose one brand over another. Boycotts and other awareness campaigns can pressure a company to conduct business differently. An area where consumers do not generally have that power is mining. Mining operates with little direct business-to-consumer transactions and with minimal transparency. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Andrew Kaminsky, a journalist for Triple Pundit, to learn more about the mining industry. We look at the environmental impacts of extracting various minerals, discuss how mining companies are changing the way they operate, and examine a promising model in Canada where mining companies are partnering with Indigenous communities in the region. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrew Kaminsky. Andrew is a sustainability writer and a journalist. Andrew, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
You've been working on this series for Triple Pundit, which chronicles a lot of the impacts of mining and the innovations in the space. You're based in South America, which is where a lot of major mining operations are underway. Before we focus on individual projects, give us kind of some overarching themes that you've pulled away in your work for this Triple Pundit series on mining. Like, where are the trends going? Are mining companies adapting to the new realities and the new demands for their products?
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Alex. I'll preface everything that I say by starting out that I'm not an expert. However, I speak to a lot of experts about the innovations in mining, the issues in mining, whether that's with human rights or environmental. So yeah, as you mentioned, I started this like responsible mining series with Triple Pundit. The series, we call it Undermining Progress, Human Rights and the Low Carbon Transition. And the idea for it was really that to reach the clean energy goals that the world has, whether that's net zero or at least lowering emissions, it's going to require a transition away from fossil fuels and into clean energies. And these clean energies require a lot of different minerals, from lithium, as you mentioned, copper, manganese, zinc, nickel, critical minerals. The list goes on. However, retrieving those, extracting those from the earth is not so straightforward and not necessarily clean, kind of undermining the whole clean energy, the push for clean energy that we mentioned. And some of those issues go on human rights, that mining companies and their security teams, mining companies will make deals with national governments or states and then disregard the local communities living near where those minerals are, because you don't find the minerals usually in the big cities. You know, when I'm in Argentina right now, there's no minerals or mining activities here in Buenos Aires. However, if you go to the northwest of the country, you'll find the lithium triangle, which, as they call it, it's shared between Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia. And that's where a lot of the mining happens. And there's a lot of indigenous communities out there who are the ones that are impacted. Now, when mining companies sign these agreements with national governments, they're like, right, we've invested X amount of money. These minerals are ours, and we're going to make sure that we get our money back and we get our money's worth for mining these. And it's the often indigenous communities, with smaller communities, rural communities, that get the short end of the stick. And of course, also environmental issues. You're blasting tons of rock. The tailings that you're using after mining the rock is processed. There's a lot of social and environmental issues, and we wanted to look at, for this series, some innovative solutions and basically responsible approaches to mining and how you could make this push for clean energy minerals less intrusive. That's essentially the idea. And yeah, some of the things that I found is that there are a lot of people working to make this, to improve the state of mining worldwide. And it's really, when you look at all the impacts that mining has, you might get a little bit depressed and say, well, this is a horrible situation. There's no right answer. Fossil fuels are bad. Mining is bad. But as you look into it, there are a lot of people, good people doing good work. And as I mentioned to you prior, like it's one of the challenges they face, though, is that mining companies are reluctant to make changes to their processes that they've been doing for decades. They get minerals out of the ground. They do it well, and they get them to market. And they're not so interested in quickly ripping out the carpet beneath them and inserting a whole new process to manage things more responsibly. Of course, they say they want to, and part of me believes that they want to, but it's not so easy to make that happen. So that's certainly one of the challenges that startup companies and even large mining companies are facing when trying to improve the state of mining around the world.
You mentioned how these mining companies are often slow to pivot to new innovative practices. Obviously, it's a very varied and large industry, and it's far from monolithic. But if we could continue down the generalization path, do you see much differentiation in terms of what minerals are being mined and the size of the mining companies? When you start covering a big mining company that's mining for, let's say, gold, do you expect different impacts than if it was a small company mining for copper or lithium? And as a subset of that, also the region and the fragility of the area that's being mined.
What I have found is that the smaller companies are generally the ones that are more open to more sustainable practices, to trying new things. And that is probably true across the board, not just for mining companies, but also for, you name whatever big brands you want to talk about, like Walmart or Unilever. They're probably less open to trying something new because there's a lot of different processes and checks that they got to go through and approvals. I don't know if the minerals matter that much. I mean, with lithium these days, it's got more of a, this is the clean energy mineral. So maybe companies are a bit more careful about what they're doing with their lithium. But to me, I haven't really noticed a trend across what the mineral is, but the location or the region does seem to matter. A lot of the human rights abuses and environmental neglect tends to happen in countries with weaker governance that have, you know, there's less eyes on them, let's say. So if you've heard about cobalt mining in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Central Africa, that might be the epicenter for human rights abuses in mining. And it's in a country that doesn't have strong governance and a lot of watchful eyes over it. So you have some African countries that struggle with mining companies. Central America as well, you see some issues, and in South America too. I mean, it really is across the board. Southeastern Asia, Southern Asia, I've seen a lot of issues, but this happens too in like, I'm from Canada. This happens in Canada. This happens in the United States. I don't know that any country or region is immune to any negative impacts of mining. It's one of the impacts of blasting millions and millions of tons of rock to extract roughly 1% of that rock. These are some of the impacts that people living in the region and the environment in those regions are going to face. And while governance plays an issue, I don't know that it protects anyone completely from the negative impacts of mining.
People say she's crazy, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of your shoes.
She was physically forgotten, but then she slipped into my pocket with my car keys. She said, "You've taken me for granted because I please you, wearing these diamonds." And I could say, "Ooh, ooh." As if everybody knows what I'm talking about. As if everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about diamonds on the soles of your shoes.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to sustainability writer and journalist Andrew Kaminsky. So, Andrew, we were talking about mining governance. Maybe you can contrast a couple of countries and mining projects that you've written about. I'm thinking about the copper mining in Panama and gold mining in Colombia. Maybe contrast those two projects and summarize those if you can as well with the Northwestern Canadian project, which has a pretty innovative partnership with the Indigenous people there. Because that would seem like the real template to build on moving forward if we can get more and more countries and companies on board with this model.
Yeah, it's a fantastic model, this co-ownership model between Skeena Resources is the name of the mining company. And I can't remember the name of the Indigenous nation that they've partnered with.
Is it Tahltan?
Yes, that's it, the Tahltan. I was lucky enough to speak with one of their elders for the article that I wrote for Triple Pundit. And it basically what I saw from the agreement between Skeena and the Tahltan was just a shared importance on mutual respect, and both parties, you know, of course they're going to have disagreements and not agree on everything, but the fact that they were both willing to respect each other, come to the table and find a way forward. And this is, it's not just something that happened, you know, last year. It's been, you know, decades in the making, this relationship. And so when you have built this trust with each other and you kind of understand that someone's not there to screw you over, you can kind of, you know, get the results you're looking for that don't need to go along with human rights abuses or environmental degradation. So now if I contrast that with, there is a case in Panama that's still going on between, it's another Canadian miner, called First Quantum. And maybe this is one of the things that got me into mining in the first place, is that a lot of the mining companies are headquartered in Canada. About 75% of mining companies are based there. And so this Canadian company that's doing work in Panama at a copper mine had been exploring the region and ended up with a contract that they signed with the Panamanian government. Now, the Supreme Court ruled that this contract was illegal. It violated the country's constitution on a number of different reasons, for reasons of environmental impact, for reasons of consultation with Indigenous communities, for reasons of corruption in the contract itself and, like, the signing of the contract. However, the mine was allowed to open somehow. The mine started and was running for a little while until the Panamanians took to the streets in October 2023 and demanded that the mine be shut down. And one of the common chants from the people is that, like, Panama is not for sale. And so eventually the Supreme Court had stepped in and the government shut down the mine. And it's been paused ever since, still to this day. Now, what happened is, well, this is obviously not a good relationship between the mining company and the local people living close to the resources. And so what's happened now, or since that, I should say, was that the Canadian company threatened a $20 billion lawsuit against Panama, saying that they prevented future earnings from First Quantum. And this is one of the fascinating things. Well, it's fascinating, but not in a good way for me anyway. It's called ISDS. It's Investor State Dispute Settlements. It's basically when a company takes a country to court because that country has done something that's affected negatively that company's investment. In this case, Panama went and said, wait a minute, this contract is unconstitutional, so we're going to pause this while we try to rework the contract. So the company went and sued the country in this ISDS mechanism for $20 billion. And now both parties have, Panama's kind of said, okay, well, wait a minute, don't do that. Let's work out an agreement. Let's find a way we can move forward and stay out of this court. So now, just recently, Panama has allowed First Quantum not to continue mining, but they're allowed to maintain the mine, whatever that means. So they're allowed to have people there. They can't actually be extracting any minerals. However, they can, with the minerals that are already extracted, use those, process them, sell them to pay for their maintenance of the mine while they try and work out a deal to restart the mine. And this is what a lot of experts refer to as regulatory chill, is this the threat of these major multi-billion dollar lawsuits that not just mining companies, but companies, other foreign companies investing in local governments. The threat of these huge billion-dollar lawsuits makes it so that these countries don't want to enact environmental protection laws. They don't want to enact human rights laws. It's, or phasing out fossil fuels. It's yeah, it's really a whole crazy world of stuff once you start digging into ISDS, which I don't know if we have the time for now. But it's those are two contrasts of very different ways that a relationship between a mining and local population can go.
And one would think on the surface that moving away from land and going into deep sea mining would eliminate that problem with populations, but it comes with a whole other host of environmental concerns. And you recently did a piece saying, is responsible deep sea mining possible? We had Daniel Kamen, the University of California, Berkeley energy professor on a few years ago, talking about how it's largely unnecessary and that it's just an inefficient, ineffective way to get these materials. And he was much more excited about the promise of growing rare minerals in laboratories. I think it's perovskites are these very promising ways to get at the kind of materials that take an awful lot of manpower to extract and degrade the seabed quite a bit. What have you learned in your reporting on the deep sea mining space?
It's fascinating. That's what I've learned. I held off for a while on exploring deep sea mining for one of these articles. Number one, because there was so much to cover on land. And then number two, I don't know, it just wasn't a major concern at the moment. But then just a month ago, roughly, if you remember, you saw the metals company applied for a permit with the U.S. government after there was an executive order that Trump gave that they're going to, you know, strengthen the U.S.'s deep sea mining and, well, critical minerals supply. So when the metals company applied for a permit with the U.S. government, which is kind of goes against the whole international governance system that the U.N., through its body called the International Seabed Authority, has been trying to set up. And this was kind of shocking to a lot of people. And this is when I felt, okay, well, maybe now is the time to dig into deep sea mining. No pun intended. So what I knew about deep sea mining prior to researching it and speaking with experts about it was essentially nothing. I just assumed, well, on land, you blast and move million tons of rock to get well, at least in gold deposits, they'll often recover less than 0.01%. So it's minuscule. So you're on land, you're moving tons of rock to recover grams. We're talking kilograms of minerals. And you know, when you translate that to the ocean, you think like, well, my God, this is going to be awful. Let's stay out of the water for now. But interestingly enough, like the more I looked into and learned about deep sea mining is that what you have are these essentially potato-sized rocks that are sitting on the seabed, and about 5,000 meters below the surface is where you find these. And they're essentially just there. There's no real digging that needs to be done to retrieve them. And they're called polymetallic nodules, and they contain four minerals primarily, which are cobalt, nickel, copper, and manganese, all of which are important to the clean energy transition. And these potato-sized rocks, the polymetallic nodules, contain a quantity of these minerals that dwarf the on-land reserves. There are way more minerals available in the ocean than there are on land. And the impact on the surface of the seabed, you're going down maybe 2 inches, 2 to 3 inches when to collect these rocks. So it's really interesting. There's so much unknown about deep sea mining still, and there, from the environmental impacts, is the primary thing that is stopping people from doing it so far, and is the big unknown from the sediment plumes that this will kick up, the dust essentially from, well, how will that impact deep sea marine ecosystems? Do these nodules produce dark oxygen? What about the sound and the light from these vessels that are out there doing the mining? There's a lot of unknowns. They're still exploring it. Is it necessary? I don't know. Is it better or worse? I don't know. I think I don't know is the big answer right now in deep sea mining.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to sustainability writer and journalist Andrew Kaminsky. So, Andrew, how have you seen the mining industry embracing the clean energy transition, and how much of it is real and how much of it is greenwashing, in your opinion?
They're embracing it full on. It's sort of their windfall is clean energy transition. And how much of this is greenwashing, I don't know. They're not so open about the impacts that they have, the environmental impacts, the human rights impacts. And it's difficult, I'll say, through the course of this series, getting mining companies to speak to me has not been easy. There's been a handful of times where I've been able to speak with some, but that's often the case. These smaller mining companies, like I mentioned, Skeena Resources, for example, that had the co-ownership model with the indigenous community. Larger mining companies, even ones that I've wanted to highlight some of the good things they're doing, they still are not willing to speak. I had to go through to eventually get the industry to talk to me. There's a the ICMM, it's called. It's a International Council on Mining and Metals, I believe. And that's sort of an industry organization. They represent mining companies. And so speaking, I've spoke with them for a couple of articles, and they represent and have as their members many of the large mining companies, and they've said, hey, I can put a message out to our members to see if anyone wants to chat, but none of the mining companies really seem that interested in speaking with me, which is, I'm not trying to demonize them. What I'm really trying to do is find solutions to some of the problems that are very well documented and well known in mining. When I started doing deep sea mining just last month, I noticed a bit of a flip there. Now, this is maybe just a one-off moment, but I found that the mining companies, the companies engaged in deep sea mining, were very willing to talk and very open and transparent about what they're doing and their processes and their intentions. And then I found a lot of the environmental organizations going shy when it came to this topic. I did eventually get one to speak to me, but that was just a one-off, unique, and I'm maybe trying to read too much into it, but that was an interesting experience I had getting sources for the deep sea mining article, and I'm working on some future ones actually now. But yeah, I don't know that mining companies are very in the public eye, whereas fossil fuel companies, like you mentioned, Shell, you know, any of the big Esso or Exxon, the big fossil fuel companies are kind of household names.
They're vertically integrated, right? So they have a point of sale. People actually buy their products directly from a Shell.
But that's exactly right. That's exactly the point, is that mining, do mining companies have an incentive to greenwash if they're not in the public eye? Like, nobody knows who mining companies are. Some of the biggest mining companies, BHP, Rio Tinto, Barrick Gold, they're not...
They don't have stores.
No, you don't go there and you don't buy copper. And the copper that they produce, someone else sells it. They pass it on to processors, and it goes through a number of hands before it ever sees anything close to a consumer. Whereas fossil fuels has, yeah, as you mentioned, that exactly, they're vertically integrated from extraction to sale. A lot of times it's the same company, hence the incentive to greenwash. And I think the fossil fuel industry has been really chastised for their role in greenwashing and trying to jump on the clean energy wave.
Andrew Kaminsky is a sustainability writer and journalist. His pieces on mining can be found at triplepundit.com. Andrew, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Les McCann and Eddie Harris, Paul Simon, and Sting. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.